Seattle loves a good myth. Underground tunnels, disappearing neighborhoods, ghosts, cryptids, all the usual local hobbies. But today's story isn't a legend somebody made up after three drinks in Pioneer Square. It's the very real, very strange life of Moses Seattle, Chief Seattle's grandson, a man whose story sits right on the line between oral tradition, historical record, and a death people tried very hard to forget.
History is messy,
weird, wild, anything but boring.
We're rainy day rabbit holes,
exploring the unhinged side of history, politics, and culture.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
Welcome to Rainy Day Rabbit Holes, where we dig into the strange, the forgotten, and the unsettling corners of history. Today's story takes us right here to the Pacific Northwest, to a name you already know, and a person you almost certainly don't. Moses Seattle was the grandson of Chief Seattle. Yeah, that's the same Seattle the city is named after. Ever heard of him? I hadn't. And there's a reason for that. His life sat in a strange place between history and story, between recognition and near total obscurity. And his death was so disturbing that those involved appear to have tried to bury the story entirely. And they nearly did. Enter the man who brought this story back into the light, David Norman Lewis. David is a Seattle-based historian, filmmaker, and writer. He's written for Seattle Weekly, The Stranger, and BlackPast.org. His films have appeared at the Northwest Film Forum's Local Sightings Festival, and if you've ever taken a Beneath the Streets tour, you may have already encountered his work, and he gives a great tour, Jody, and I can attest.
I can attest. It was really a lot of fun, and I feel like we are qualified at rating tours.
We are. It's part of our thing. He's also the author of Evergreen Ape, exploring the origins of the Bigfoot legend in the Pacific Northwest. And now, The Burning of Moses Seattle. David, welcome.
Hey, great to be here.
All right, so I think we're going to just jump right into this, what we're here to talk about today. So in your book, The Burning of Moses Seattle, you tell the story of Chief Seattle's grandson, Moses Seattle. Who was Moses Seattle, and what drew you to this story?
Well, Moses Seattle was Chief Seattle's grandson. He wasn't born until after Chief Seattle's death, though. In a lot of ways, you know, I'd actually say that Moses Seattle's story starts with Chief Seattle's funeral. But first, why I was drawn to it. I just ran across him in an old history book. There was a brief mention that Chief Seattle's grandson was a dwarf who was, quote, the pet of the tribe. I thought that sounded interesting, so I looked him up, and I found all of these newspaper articles about his murder. So I thought, wow, it's very odd. This guy is not more famous.
Yeah, absolutely. I had never heard of Moses Seattle before. Jody, had you?
No, I had not. And I love Native American history. Like, that's some of the focus of the stories that I've done. And I focused on that in nursing school as part of, you know, cultural stuff. And so I was very surprised to hear this story.
Well, before we go any further and dive into this story, I just really want to briefly touch on terminology so that we're being respectful in how we talk about the people in this story. And in your book and in many historical resources, the word Indian appears alongside specific tribal names. And I'm just wondering how we should understand that name. And is that a term that is still accepted to be used when talking about indigenous people in this area?
Well, there's no definitive answer to that. The tribes here do prefer the word Indian.
Okay.
If you go to their websites, they normally identify as like the Tulalip tribes of Indians, or even the Duwamish tribe, who are not recognized, consider themselves the Duwamish tribe of Indians.
Okay.
Of course, there's huge generational differences. Older people tend to prefer Indian. Some younger people prefer indigenous or native. It really depends on who you ask and what groups they're part of.
Yeah, when I was looking into this, I did see that. And in Canada, a lot of the groups up there, communities up there, prefer First Nations people. So I just wanted to make that clear in case anybody was like, wait, is that considered derogatory or offensive? So it's pretty clear that we're good to go. Okay, so let's get into it. When you tell the story of Moses Seattle, where do you begin?
Well, I would say in a lot of ways, Moses Seattle's story starts with Chief Seattle's funeral. Because at his funeral, Chief Seattle's son, Jim Seattle, he gives a great speech about his father, where he holds up that famous photograph of Chief Seattle, the only photo ever taken. And Jim deeply expresses his concern that in the future, that one photograph might be the only thing left of his family. At the time, even Jim's sister, Angeline, wasn't photographed yet, and she later became famous for all the pictures of her. But all of Jim's own children have already died from the new diseases, and his wife is barren, so he really is not sure if his bloodline is going to continue or not. He learns that a local Duwamish doctor, Dr. Steve, he has a cure for infertility, but it involves grinding down a ghost from the land where the dead await reincarnation. The native people here believed that the dead would go to a different land, and then they would kind of be broken down into pellets of life and then reincarnated back as humans. So a doctor could go there, kidnap a ghost, and grind them down and give this ointment to women. It's described as like a red jelly-like substance, and that would cure infertility. But a side effect of these medicines is that babies born this way always came out as dwarves.
Interesting.
Curiously, a lot of sources mention specifically dwarves with no bones.
Right. I found that interesting, too, when I was reading. What do you mean no bones?
So just a mound of human flesh?
Yeah.
That's the way they describe it. And that gets complicated because the condition they're describing actually is a real thing. There's a condition called osteogenesis imperfecta, which causes dwarfism and like glass bone disease, where you can like break someone's bones just by basically touching them. And this is real, but Moses Seattle probably did not actually have this, because although he was a dwarf, all people who met him were impressed by his like superhuman strength. He was over 200 pounds of muscle and physically extremely strong. So he probably did not have osteogenesis imperfecta. But we do have multiple sources from both Suquamish and in Twana narratives, the Allen brothers mention he had no bones. So I have no idea what that meant. But people who knew him personally do confirm that he was born as like a gelatinous pile of flesh.
Well, I mean, babies sometimes do just look like that anyway. But I mean, he wouldn't have been doing like the springing up from a prone position
without bones,
or because that would break his bones.
I'm wondering if he was like really flexible is the real problem. And so he was just kind of floppier.
Yeah, apparently he was really flexible. An early account of him mentions when he was a kid, he could twist his body into any shape.
Oh, wow.
That's what I was thinking. And so then they're thinking he has no bones, but really he's just got loose ligaments.
So I want to do a really quick side quest. How does one kidnap a ghost?
right. And is this evil? Like, it sounds like you're interfering with a process that's divine or something.
Is the ghost not happy about this? Like, I'm interested in this.
You're literally stealing a soul. What's happening?
Well, with the native accounts, the way they would see it is ghosts kidnap people all the time. They believed it was one of the main things that caused sickness. Oh. Where that's actually one of the reasons why if you had a like close family member or a friend die, you would change your name for fear that they would come back and like steal your soul to keep them company in the land of the dead.
Oh, interesting.
So that's why you would change your name so they couldn't find you, and why they never spoke the name of the dead because they didn't want to call them back. And they believe that if the doctor was unable to find your soul in the land of the dead, then you would die soon.
Interesting.
And it's really interesting. You brought up the word evil, and the native concept of evil is much different from ours, where they believe in ghosts kidnapping souls. They believe in like earth dwarves stealing people's sanity. But it's not like in Christian culture where they do it out of like temptation. Because they want your soul in and of itself. It's normally they want you for something and basically want to have you to serve a purpose for them. And the native people here did not see ghosts or dwarves acting any differently than they would if they were in their same situation. Because they also kidnap people frequently around
here. So it's all about perspective and whose needs are the hierarchy of needs.
Right.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know,
yeah.
And I'm interested. So you've got Moses Seattle, this gelatinous pile of flesh being born. But, you know, it's probably fairly evident fairly on that he doesn't have a, you know, regular development, and then he has dwarfism. Is how do the native people see dwarves and people with these kind of conditions? Is it something that they look down upon, or how do they accept these people into their community?
That's a very good question. The family knew going in that he was going to come out as a dwarf, because babies born this way always came out this way. And how you would be treated as someone with any kind of condition really comes down to who your parents are. Oh. So you can't really use Moses as a representative example of everyone with his condition, because he's from a very illustrious family. They're Seobs, which means high bloods. So he's born with a very high social standing. And also, according to those who met him, he was pretty arrogant about that. One time when he's arrested in Tacoma, he's yelling at the cops that his grandfather is Chief Seattle, and they're to treat him accordingly.
Which was, I don't know, is that good or bad?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, so see, even with the, very well. Actually, back then, Tacoma, because they wanted to get Mount Rainier renamed Mount Tacoma, they had a very strong culture of respecting Native rights. Right. Because they wanted to promote them as a people with, quote, a mythology worthy of Greek or Norse mythology, so they could get that Mount
Rainier. So this is the era where they flipped the script, huh? On how they view the natives. And once they were something to conquer and destroy and get out of the way, and now they're something to honor with lore.
Or is it honoring or using them as propaganda?
Yeah, I was going to say, one town only flips that script, and they really only flip that script on one issue, that you need to respect them so we can get the mountain
name. Oh, God.
Because if we get the mountain name to Mount Tacoma, here we are, City of Tacoma. Hmm. There's our mountain.
Yeah. Moses wrote a letter in approval of this, but he pointed out it's really more pronounced like Mount Tacoma instead of Tacoma.
Yeah, I've heard Tacoma and Tacoma and Tacobit, and I have no idea which one is supposed to be correct. So,
well, there was a Tacoma lawyer back in the 1880s. He gathered 20 of the oldest native people he could find to get the correct pronunciation, and no two of them pronounced it even remotely closely similar. Yeah, that was also like back in the 70s when Avi Hilbert first started doing her projects to bring back Lachute Seed culture. There were still a lot of people alive at Tulalip who spoke Lachute Seed, and she went out there to teach classes, and none of them could understand anything she was saying. Because she spoke a Skagit dialect, and it was so
like,
different.
What are you talking?
That even if you basically spoke the same language, you couldn't understand
it.
So let's get back to Moses's beginnings here. What kind of world was he born into, you know, culturally and even politically here, because he was part of this high blood family? So was he treated differently by not only his own people, but the white settlers in the area?
Well, early on, he barely ever even saw any white people. He only comes up in the historical record when he's around 7, 8, 9, 10-ish years old. And back then, the Suquamish Reservation was considered pretty remote. He doesn't speak any English at all until he goes to boarding school when he's like 10 or 11. So early on, it would have only been native people. And apparently, he's treated pretty well. He was quite popular on the reservation. And the family, they had sort of a dip in their status, because his father, Jim Seattle, had a reputation for being kind of a jerk and demanding of people. So some people say that he was demoted from like the higher up status that he used to have, where other people say it more depends on the group you were talking with. And some people still held him in pretty high regards.
And is Jim Chief Seattle's only son, only offspring?
He was his only surviving son at the time of Chief Seattle's death. No one has any idea how many daughters Chief Seattle had. Three of them are just listed as girl, girl, girl on a family tree.
That tracks.
Yeah, but he had two older sons. He had Sequat, who died in combat. And then he had a son named George, who died shortly before Chief Seattle's death. So Jim was the youngest of the three, but he was the only boy left.
I find the name choices interesting.
Yeah, did Indian people have, did they have an Indian name and then like a more white name too? Or did they just start adopting these more, you know, white names?
Oh, no, they're all named Jim. they definitely had a Lachute seed name. But in English, they typically take the name Jim, and then they put some adjective before it, like Yelm Jim, or Big Jim, Little Jim, something like that, something before the Jim. So it was one of the few English words they could pronounce easily. Oh, that and Moses, because it has no R's. That's why there's also a lot of native people who take the name Moses.
Interesting.
So George and Jim definitely were not their Lachute Sioux names.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. That was like, whoa.
The reservation obviously played a big role in Moses's life. But then it sounds like this Indian boarding school played a pretty significant role in shaping young Moses. Tell us about that.
Well, he didn't go to boarding school at all until after his father dies. Jim Seattle was very opposed to assimilation. Mm-hmm. He refused to speak English with visitors, even though everyone knew he was fluent and used to translate for his father. And early on, Moses Seattle's mom wouldn't even reveal his age, probably because she didn't want him in the boarding school. But after Jim dies, they kind of realize they have to assimilate. And at first he goes to the Tulalip school, and he's in the school magazine there, like the student newspaper. But apparently there are no official records of him being there. And that's a complaint a lot of people have had about that school, that the numbers just don't add up attendance-wise. There were a lot of students who were there who were clearly kept off the books. And Harriet Shelton, who was a Snohomish elder, these accusations, they're hard to like exactly state, but basically what she implied was they were keeping a lot of people off the books because the student death rate there was so high, they didn't want them on paper in case of like investigations.
That's what I was wondering.
So would they kind of pick and choose students that maybe seemed like they were more sickly or weak that, well, this one has a good chance of dying under these conditions, so let's keep them off the books?
Yeah, exactly. And Harriet Shelton said the other big thing they would do was if a student was like on the verge of death, they would send them home so they didn't officially die on the school grounds.
Oh, good grief. We haven't gotten into the Indian schools yet because I don't know that we could handle
it. I can't handle it. I've read enough into it. It just upsets me and infuriates me.
That'd be a bummer of an episode.
It's just insane.
Yeah, but the hard part is, like, a lot of it, like, you can't really prove it either way, because you're dealing with a population where, in a lot of cases, the parents live in total poverty, can't speak English, they can't read or write, and the only recourse they have is through Indian agents who work for the same people as the schools do.
Yeah, they were truly trapped in their situation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, literally, yeah, prisoners.
He's in this Indian boarding school. What was his time like there? I mean, did he make friends? Did he have a hard time with school? What, you know, are, is there any records of people talking about what kind of student he was?
There actually is. He was in the student newspaper. They said his nickname there was Little Samson because he was so strong. They mentioned that he likes to play all the time. He's very physically active. They mentioned he does not like studying very much, and he speaks basically no English at that point.
Were the teachers at these schools, were they, I'm assuming some of them were fairly abusive, especially when a child refused to speak English. I mean, is that something that Moses would have had to deal with, as maybe beatings and ridicule from
staff? Yeah, probably. They mentioned that there was A lot of beatings at the school, shaving their heads, forcing boys to wear dresses. It gets pretty sadistic. But we know he wasn't at the Tulalip boarding school for that long, because his mom died, I think within a year of his father. And Moses Seattle's stepfather, Chief Chico, that name Chico is a variation of Chaco Boston, which means become American in Chinook jargon, where if you renounced all tribal affiliation, you could get a land grant, like a white settler, which is what his stepfather did. And also, if you were Chaco Boston, you were not considered a ward of the state and did not have to send your kids to the boarding school. So we know his stepfather pulls him out, and then he starts attending classes at, the local one-room schoolhouse.
Where was that located?
It was on Dyes Inlet. Oh. He had to canoe there day with two white kids that his stepfather was friends with. And it was actually while canoeing to school, Moses and this white boy, they got in a fight. The canoe capsized. And because of Moses's square body, he bobbed like a cork. But the two white kids, they just went straight down into the water. Moses swam down. He was able to rescue the girl. I think the boy vanished forever. I don't even know if they found the body. But Moses got the girl back up to the surface, got her on his capsized canoe, and they basically both just floated there for, I believe, a couple hours until rescue came. It was after that, a photographer offered to give Moses $20 for his photo, which was like almost a month's payback then. But Moses turned the guy down because he was completely aware why he wanted to pay that much. It wasn't because he thought he was a hero. He wanted to sell some dwarf photos.
Yeah. Of a famous dwarf.
Well, did he ever take any blame for the death of the little boy?
No. He was seen as like a small town hero then.
For saving the girl.
For saving the girl. Apparently he never got any reward money from it. But yeah, no, everyone was very much on his side. And then he finished up his education down at a technical school in Oregon, where he hurt himself in a gymnastics class as the base of a human pyramid.
Because this technical school is for gymnastics?
Taking some gymnastics down there.
What was the trade that he was learning in this technical school? Do you know?
I do not, but I know he graduated with a high school degree.
Okay. And so go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was going to say it did him very little good. He's on the census. He's just listed as day laborer, but he could read and write, and he wrote some letters to newspapers. So he
moves back up to the Puget Sound after he's done with that technical school in Oregon.
Yeah. And he works a lot of odd jobs here. Fisher does a bit of fishing, hot picking, plays accordion at all night dances.
Oh, all night dances with accordion music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Polkas. Poppin'. Square dances.
It's like the discos of Seattle of the time.
The native communities here, they like to do, they normally dance from around 8 p.m., around dusk, until the next morning. They normally went on all night. And then around midnight, they would break for a potluck dinner and then go back to dancing. There's even newspaper articles from the time asking white people not to encourage them because it makes it so they don't go to church the next day and that they don't work in the morning. So it says, please do not attend their dances.
They're so fun.
Yeah. So was playing the accordion for Indian dances or for dances at the saloons and stuff in Seattle for white people?
Well, they were mixed. Anyone could go to those dances. They would always get a lot of, it would be typically more white men than white women attending them. But yeah, no, there were whole bunches of people at all of them. And I believe it was mostly native dances that he played at. And I think a few in Seattle, Tacoma, but that's not really recorded.
So how was he treated by the broader community as an adult, like the Seattle community?
Well, he definitely stuck out. For a long time, he never comes to Seattle. He preferred Tacoma at first. Doesn't come to Seattle until after his Aunt Angeline dies, because apparently they had some kind of falling out. And yet he won't set foot in the city until after she's dead. And then the newspapers mention he seems extremely nervous. But as you can imagine, you know, if you're a dwarf in the 1890s, no matter what your skin color, you're going to get a lot of
Yeah, for sure. So where was he living at this time, though? Was he living on the reservation?
Well, he lives all over. And that's the other thing that's hard to track is because he has a gigantic extended family. Like, he has family everywhere. So he lives on the reservation. He lives in a longhouse out at Erland Point, Tacoma, Seattle, the White River, Bremerton, Charleston. During the hop season, he lives in Issaquah. Very migratory kind of life.
Wow, he really gets around.
Mm-hmm. I do find it interesting that he chose Tacoma over a city named after his grandfather. I prefer Tacoma over Seattle, but I am not related to Chief Seattle.
Right.
Yes, I think another one of Chief Seattle's grandkids, Enna DeShaw, also greatly disliked Seattle. She didn't like coming here.
Interesting.
So we know that he's done all these different odd jobs, day labor type of jobs and playing music. But he also performed in a circus, right?
Yeah, he tried the freak show racket for a little bit. His act was he played the wild man from Spanish Flats, where Spanish Flats, I looked it up. It's a like boom gold mining town down in California. It was like abandoned after the 49 gold rush. So it's barely even a real place. But according to the Barker, Moses was caught from a tribe of mud eaters. Oh, so primitive, they've never learned to hand each other things, and their favorite food is mud.
Oh my God.
And then the carnival barker would just throw mud at his face, and Moses would like catch it in his mouth and then flop around on stage in a big pile of mud. The mud was apparently actually made out of chocolate.
Oh okay.
But it was the only payment he ever got because the barker sniffed him, and that was when Moses's showbiz career ended.
So not only was he being humiliated and exploited because of his shape, but then he also gets stiffed. Don't even make any money off of it. Yeah.
Shape and skin color. There's a very strong racial component to that act as well.
And when would have that been about? Was the early 1910s or so?
This would have been 1890s, okay. Early 1900s, because he dies in 1905 and he doesn't come to Seattle until, I believe, 1897 or 1898. So it would have been in that era.
Okay. I mean, it kind of makes sense. The racist, very racist, very exploitative freak shows and circus acts of the time.
Yeah, I can't imagine being him in that era. I mean, it'd be hard now.
Yeah.
For a while, he tried changing his name and, like, you know, laying low. He tried changing his name to Indian Sam and, like, working along the waterfront. But when you're locally famous and 4 feet tall, it's pretty hard to change your identity.
Yeah, there's probably not a lot of people in the Puget Sound area at that time that look like him.
Apparently he was the very first newspaper accounts of him when he's like a kid in the 1870s. They mention that there's one other native dwarf on Puget Sound who's half black. But after that, they all mention Moses is the only one.
Sure. So I'm wondering, though, when he spent this time in the circus act, freak show act, did his community have a problem with that? Because
actually, some came out to see it. That's how we have a record of it. It was in the 1940s. The writer Ernest Bertelsen interviewed elders who remembered going over to Seattle and watching the show. They actually said it was a pretty good show. They said he was a very good performer, whether he was very athletic and always gave his all.
Hmm. I wonder if he enjoyed that work at all or if how he felt about the exploitation part of it.
Well, he was playing a character and he's also in the act. He's not even playing an Indian. He's playing someone from like a fictional country that doesn't exist somewhere else.
So it feels all make-believe and fine.
Or it's not reflecting poorly on his specific people. I mean, he quit doing it, so we know he had issue with it. But also, he wasn't getting paid. So
I mean,
that
that's a big issue. Yeah,
issue. Yeah, yeah, that's a big
I'd
issue.
I'd have an issue with that too if I was doing anything I was supposed to be getting paid for. So, in your book, you describe Moses's alcoholism and how that played a pretty significant role in his life. So what role did alcohol and his alcoholism play in his life and then eventually lead to the circumstances surrounding his death?
Well, yeah, it's the thing that eventually kills him. He was a lifelong alcoholic to the point that's where a lot of his like early arrest in Tacoma, it's a public drunkenness arrest. It was so bad when he died, when they did the autopsy on him, the doctor said his liver was so swollen, it was pressing against his lung and his heart. Jeez.
Wow, that's craziness.
And that's also why it's hard to, people were never able to determine his age just by looking at him.
Yeah.
Because when he was a kid, other kids at the school with him mentioned that he has a very deep, coarse voice like an adult and looks like an adult. But then if you see pictures of him in his 20s, he looks like he's 11. And then when he died, a lot of people thought he was 10 years older than he actually was from the hardcore alcohol abuse.
Well, yeah, between that and, you know, laboring in the sun and environment all the time. And yeah. Was alcoholism a problem for the Native community in those days?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's kind of ubiquitous across Native communities.
Is that where it became a real problem when they hit the reservations and were confined to that life?
Yeah, it's still debated whether or not there is like a biological component, because traditionally they had no immunity to it, or if it was just like a psychological thing brought on by the despair of the reservation.
I mean, when you have nothing else to live for, I mean, when your whole culture, your livelihood, the way of life is gone and you're stuck in this space, you know, that's a great option for getting through it.
And also, I mean, the Indian agents, they kind of used alcohol to police those communities. Mm-hmm. By making sure, William DeShaw, he was the main Indian agent at Suquamish, and he also ran the store there. And the Suquamish claimed that he was the one flooding their reservation with whiskey in order to keep them
down. Yeah, I mean, it's just another strategy to eliminate them from...
Yeah, to keep them compliant.
Compliant, keep them out of the way, continue to take advantage of the...
Well, and to kill them off was the main goal. But on the same side, though, it was also illegal to sell whiskey to Native people, so they could kind of use both of supplying them with the whiskey and then arresting them for it.
Oh, that's fantastic!
Oh, yeah, what a great tactic! Wow.
Yeah. And that's actually the thing that leads to Moses Seattle's death, because his cousin Bob Purcell it's pronounced both. I think it's Purcell is the way it's said in America. But yeah, Bob Purcell, he had found some sailors to buy them whiskey, and then that led to the incident.
Wow.
Before we get to this incident, let's take a quick break so that people can kind of mentally prepare. It's going to get a little bit dark when we come back from the break. So go get a drink of water, take a breath, and we'll be right back after this quick break. All right, we are back. We are here with David Norman Lewis, the author of The Burning of Moses Seattle. Now, we've talked a lot about Moses' upbringing, his role in Seattle, and kind of the circumstances that are leading up to his very tragic demise. But before we get to that, is there anything else you want to talk about as far as his life and his impact on Seattle before we get into the darkness here?
I think we've covered most of it. The one thing I would like more information about is I've heard rumors he was a labor organizer back then among the hop pickers. And I found like just the slightest hints of it. So if anyone out there knows anything about this, I'd be very, very interested. I know some of these sources exist because I've seen them before I was writing about him, but I cannot track them down anymore.
So without getting into more detail that you're comfortable sharing right now, what are the key events that led to Moses Seattle's death?
Ooh, where to start with that? I would say, you know, in some ways it starts with the bubonic plague, because that's when they really start building up the Navy here on Puget Sound, when there's the plague outbreak in San Francisco.
Okay.
the Navy realizes they really have to spread things out, and they start building up Bremerton a lot more. But they have the problem of here on Puget Sound, the alcoholism is so bad that the Navy and the Marines, they're getting so drunk in the Bremerton saloons that they're fighting each other like rival street gangs. So the Navy shuts down Bremerton, and they say no more repair work is going to be sent there unless all the Navy towns go totally dry. Like, the mayor is walking around feeling floorboards to make sure there's no hiding spaces or people are hiding whiskey.
Wow.
Because it's still early enough. Bremerton's a great harbor, but they've really only for a couple years been breaking things outside of California that the Navy still can shut it down if the towns get in the way. And Teddy Roosevelt himself, as president, had to come out here to check out the Navy towns to make sure it was safe to reopen.
Oh, no. I'm calling Dad.
So,
right? I wonder if that's when he visited Stadium High School.
Oh, yeah, I wonder.
Yeah,
probably.
While he was out.
1904?
Yeah,
on his.
No, because 1904, yeah, stadium wasn't open yet. So, but anyways, okay, so Bremerton. So Moses must be hanging out in Bremerton at this time.
He's living in Charleston at the time. And because all alcohol is illegal in Charleston and Bremerton, as you can imagine, the sailors don't like this. And they've also shut down all the brothels. So the Indians, they have like a party shack out in the woods. And Moses's cousin Bob is hitting up sailors saying, like, if you buy us whiskey at one of these other towns, we can make sure you have a good time. So he finds some sailors to buy them whiskey and beer. They're having a party out in the woods, and it's going well until the sailors get so drunk that they scare off all the Indian women. The women run away, and then the sailors think they've been scammed.
Oh.
And then after
that, it couldn't
be
them.
No one will testify about what happened. Everyone claims they were so drunk that they have no memory of it. But according to the earliest newspaper reports, the sailors started fighting the Indians. They were beating up Moses' cousin. And at some point, Moses falls in the fire. Ernest Bertelsen, who lived on the Suquamish Reservation, he's actually the only white who's buried in the Suquamish graveyard. Oh. He interviewed people in the 1940s where enough time had passed where they were finally willing to talk about it. And some Suquamish people told him the first time Moses fell in the fire, it was an accident where he just tripped during the fight. But he looked so funny jumping out of the fire that everyone started laughing and it broke the tension. And because it broke the tension, they kept throwing him back in the fire over and over again. And then the sailors got so drunk that one of them held him down and they shoved a burning fire poker into his side and burned a hole through his abdomen.
Oh my God.
And then one just held him down in the flames until the flesh was cooked from his bones.
Oh, my God.
And then he lived.
Yeah, there are also some people who said it was his cousin Bob holding him down. But then other people said his cousin Bob was actually trying to beat the fire out.
Oh.
And it just looked like he was burning him. But he was like trying to like beat the flames down. Anyway, when they realized the burns, they covered over three quarters of his body. There are pictures. It's really at first I thought he was wearing a blanket. He's so burnt up in the photo. But when they realized that they basically committed murder, the entire group, sailors and Indians, they all flee the cabin. 3 days later, his friends come back to pick up his body and they find out that Moses is still alive.
Wow. Oh, crazy. 3 days later.
Yeah.
Jeez.
3 days later, alone in the woods in February, completely covered in lethal burns and going through alcohol
withdrawal. So they just left him. They just left him.
Well, if you see the pictures of him, you can see why they thought he was dead.
Okay, yeah, I just looked at the picture again, and it's horrifying. Yeah, it looks like he's wearing
a
like fuzzy suit on half of his body, but it's just his burnt flesh. Yeah. It's
The burn specialist who examines him, says most people would have died on the spot from that. The family had very good genes. The Seattle family, the C part of their name refers to their good blood. But Moses's cousin, Angeline, 1 year before she died of old age, she tumbled down like a 10-step flight of stairs and then just walked it off with no serious
wow,
injuries.
Wow, so they're tough as nails, the Seattles.
Resilient.
Yeah. Yeah, they are really physically extremely strong.
To have survived the initial burn is one thing, and to survive for three more days is another. There's so many aspects to that. You dehydrate, really. And
then also going through alcohol withdrawal.
Yeah.
On top of that.
Well, and that might, if it was bad enough, keep him from realizing what was happening. They get really delirious. So, you know, that might have been beneficial in that case for him. He would have not maybe have known if it was bad enough.
You know, when they find him, his friends, they load him in a canoe and they take him over to the Navy town of Charleston. And every door in town is slammed in their face. Nobody wants to get involved because they're on thin ice with the Navy from the scandal a couple years earlier. And they don't want to be involved in anything involving sailors and alcohol. So the town, they're debating whether or not they have to treat him at all. They won't even give him bandages to replace the burned rags that he's wearing. Eventually, one guy in town says it's okay for them to put Moses in his stable with the horses, but he's not allowed inside, and they put him on like a pile of gunny sacks.
Great. Now we've got like horse poop and stuff around there into wounds. Yay. Okay, so he's in this stable.
Yeah.
But
because of the Navy presence, though, there is a burn specialist right down the boardwalk at Bremerton, Dr. Fauntleroy. And he's an expert on burns because the new battleships, they're trying to get them out so fast for the Spanish-American War. They're not really doing a ton of safety checks.
Safety's not first.
And the turret. Exactly. No, they just got to get them out. So the new battleships, the turning mechanism in the new turrets, they have a tendency to jam and then explode. So Dr. Fauntleroy has treated dozens and dozens of people who have been burned alive by these, and he's intrigued by the case. He comes out and he finally agrees to give Moses treatment.
Okay, so Dr. Fauntleroy has now got Moses because out of curiosity. So when Moses is finally having some medical care, and tell us about what does Dr. Fauntleroy do to poor Moses in the name of trying to help him?
Well, in that case, he finally gets good treatment. Dr. Fauntleroy even designs a new kind of bed for him where it's a piece of stretched out canvas with holes punched in it so he can rest under a boric acid bath going over the burns without the acid pooling around him so it can drain.
What's the boric acid do for the burns?
I don't think they use it anymore, but I think it soothes it.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of things from back then that were standard medicine. Yeah. Like he also gives him strychnine, which is like rat poison. But at the time they used to use it because it was good for like simulating digestion or something. Or like black coffee enemas.
I mean, they still do that today, but not medically.
That is still a thing? Oh.
So he's giving him strychnine, enemas, boric acid baths.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that seems strange now, but at the time was legitimate treatment.
Sure.
And then he keeps him on a regimen of brandy to prevent him from dying from withdrawals.
Oh, that is a thing. You can die from alcohol withdrawal. Yeah. That probably helped him a little bit, too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Probably.
Yeah, Dr. Fauntleroy, he also realized early on after the first newspaper accounts, all the blame is taken away from the Navy, and it's all pinned on Moses Seattle's cousin Bob is the only one who's blamed in the later accounts. And for the book, actually, I did a Freedom of Information request with the Navy, and they have no record of this at all, which means they never even investigated.
That's advantageous.
Because by now, anything would have been declassified. So that means they never even looked into it, of the accusations against the sailors.
Yeah, they definitely wanted to bury this story.
Especially during the Spanish-American War, because there had been a lot of cases of American soldiers, like killing Filipino civilians, children, all kinds of stuff. They did not need another scandal like this.
So how long did he last under Dr. Fauntleroy's care?
Over a week. Wow. And yeah, Dr. Fauntleroy said if not for his alcoholism, he probably would have survived with extensive skin grafts because his genes were really good.
Wait, so they were doing skin grafts back then even?
Yeah, yeah, they could do a skin graft back then.
Wow. So he passes away a week later. Was anybody, any of his family or anybody that knew him there with him when he passed?
Apparently not. I think he dies at like 4 a.m. or something. And he's on a ship at this point. He's on the USS Philadelphia, which is like a floating hospital. Okay. So non-Navy personnel wouldn't have even been able to like be on it outside of visiting hours. We know his own people visited him quite a bit leading up to his death. Oh, he even got a visit by Lily Sparks, that girl he rescued from drowning.
Oh, wow.
They'd remained lifelong friends. She said Moses used to bring her the most wonderful shells.
Oh, that's actually sweet.
The last time he ever smiled in his life was when she visited
him. That makes me want to cry.
But we know the Suquamish were out there quite a bit because when Moses was dying, they were petitioning to get his body back after his death. They did not want him being kept as like a medical specimen. Mm-hmm. And in writing, Dr. Fauntleroy never mentions that he has any plans on doing this, but the native people were just concerned that he seemed to be too interested in treating Moses. And at the time, there has always been a big issue of, like, taking native skulls as, like, specimens, or, like, putting them in the Smithsonian. Mm. So they did not want him winding up in a jar of formaldehyde. So they published a letter in the paper at the time making it clear that after Moses died, they wanted him back for burial with his family.
So was he given back to his family to be buried?
Yeah, yeah. He's out on the reservation right now. His grave, it says Moses Self, which is odd because the Self is not really how you say Seattle's name. There's not even a TH sound in Lachute Seed.
Yeah, and that's another thing that you address in your book because, you know, as people who live in or around Seattle, we have been told for years that, oh, no, it's not Seattle. Was it Chief Seattle? It was Chief Self. But yes. You're saying that we've been being lied to.
Yeah, I mean, the real final consonant in that name, it has a sound that doesn't exist in English. It's called a glottalized barbed lambda. And I can't do it that well. I know a couple people who can. But basically, you put your tongue on the front of your teeth and you exhale sharply around it. It's like siak.
Okay.
Yes.
But yeah, I do it terribly. But
well, I was going to say, what's the aftermath of Moses' death? I mean, were any of his family trying to call for any sort of justice? Was anybody prosecuted for this?
Not really. I mean, one thing about Indians is then and now, they're really reluctant to in any way work with white authorities, like, at all. And even Moses Seattle, Dr. Fauntleroy was aware, like, he found the scar on him from where the fire poker was jammed through his abdomen. And Dr. Fauntleroy knew that there was no way that was caused by a burn. But Moses claimed that he had just woken up like that. He had no memory at all of what happened to him, where he wouldn't testify against anybody.
Wow.
Which is the native custom. They just, do not work with white authorities.
Even in this case. That's just...
Yeah. Well, I mean, because their theory is... it was great. Remember, years ago, I was reading this article about how in Baltimore, even like people who've been like victimized by gangs, they can't get them to testify. And a gang member had a great point. He said, the government doesn't like snitching either. They call it treason.
Oh, that's funny. That is funny. And
it's like that is accurate. So the native perspective is if you like go to the white authorities with this stuff, you're acknowledging that they have a right to rule over you and sort this stuff out.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, yeah, that absolutely makes sense.
Yeah, so that's why they won't work with them, because they view them as like a occupying force, which from their perspective they are. It's kind of like it'd be like the dilemma of what would you do with a serial killer if you lived in Nazi Germany? Like, do you contact the SS?
Yeah,
like, that's how they would consider this.
Interesting. So why do you think it is that Moses's story had faded from, you know, broader public memory, and that most people have no idea who this person is when they know who Chief Seattle is?
Well, I mean, most things fade here. I mean, you'd say most people know who Chief Seattle is, but there wasn't a biography of Chief Seattle until what, like 2017, 2018?
Whoa.
The David Berge one. Oh, and that one's out of print now. Sasquatch Books, they pulled it.
So it's going to fade away again.
Yeah, he's trying to get it republished now. He's looking at a couple companies. But yeah, I would say there's really not a ton of interest in Native history out here.
Which is a shame.
And Moses died in 1905. So yeah, that's a lot of time for stuff to be lost.
And so speaking of stuff being lost, this couldn't have been an easy story to research, given that, you know, there's probably a lot of it lives in oral tradition. Written records are messy and you can't find them, and then there's probably, you know, they're affected by bias and the times and conflicting accounts. And I did notice in your book that it doesn't include a bibliography or end notes, so I was curious about some of your sources.
The new edition will have a bibliography.
Okay, excellent.
Getting that together. The sources, he's in a lot of newspaper accounts from back then. He's mentioned in some anthropologists' writing. There's a book called Twana Narratives where the Allen brothers talk about him. He's in a lot of papers from back then. He's in the student newspaper. And one benefit of him being 4 feet tall is he really sticks out in photographs.
Yeah. Yeah, I did notice you have quite a few pictures of him in the book.
This evoked a lot of emotions, thoughts, and questions, actually. One of the things the book did for me is it bridged a gap in time for my knowledge of American Native or Indian history. And, you know, it starts with Christopher Columbus coming, and then we know what happens from there until we hit reservations. A little bit after that, you know, as they continue to contain them or eliminate them, really, and Indian schools. And then they kind of drop off any radar, really, or a part of our story until maybe fishing wars or even, you know, casinos and rebuilding now is what they're doing. And so this kind of filled some gaps in time. And it also made me realize we see Native American history or Indian history as an overall, they're all just one mob. And we have very little micro stories like this. There are very few personal history stories for their culture, their lineage, all of that. So it's just kind of it was a really good eye opener for me personally. It was just depressing to see that as humans, we've just done this. And I want to look back at this and go, oh my goodness, I'm so glad we're not like that anymore. And then I look and I'm like, oh no, we have a government that's celebrating in inhumane treatment of brown people still.
Yep.
Demonizing them as immigrants. And what? How did this government even get here in the first place? They were immigrants. And it's depressing.
Yeah. Yeah. That is the thing about, you know, this story is kind of a bummer of a story, but it's important.
It is so important to know. And I think that's part of the problem. We don't focus on these stories. And so we see the big story maybe, and we can not see it as a human story when we see it as a big picture story. And when you have these stories, it's a human story. We should be looking at these people as humans. So it's thank you for the story.
Oh, thank you. But yeah, I was going to say, when you were saying like the micro history, so I was going to say on Puget Sound, it is micro history in micro history in micro history. And that's why it can be hard to write about, because you get very radically different takes on very small points. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever met Ken Workman. He was with the Duwamish tribe. He's a great grandson of Chief Seattle. It's four greats. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me There's still, in a lot of Native circles, people who view Chief Seattle as being a total traitor, yeah. Mm-hmm. And him being related to Chief Seattle is not a plus with them.
I was curious about that because, you know, he signed the treaty.
He did, but there's some debate of if he actually had that authority.
Oh, wow.
Mm. Even at the time, there were Duwamish who I think they contacted. It was a member of the Denny family. I forget who they contacted, but it eventually gets to Governor Stevens that a lot of Duwamish do not consider him to be their chief and don't want him speaking for them.
Interesting.
And that was even the case, a later Duwamish chief who's recognized as a one of Chief Seattle's successors, Chief Satiakum. He claimed that Chief Seattle was never a real chief and was just an opportunist.
I was curious about that, too. Like, how do they come to a leader? How does that get decided? And how do they get the power to say, okay, now all the people, yes, I agree, we're going to go live on a reservation now?
Well, that's a that is a question that has no real answer. Depend on who you would mm-hmm. ask. Historically, I would say historically they might have a chief like that for treaty negotiations, but it would only be for like a. Because that would also depend on the tribe. Like, I know during the negotiations, the Makah, they refused to have any single one individual represent them at all. And then other ones, it was kind of assigned by the government.
Mm. Yeah, that...
So that the answer to that question would swing wildly based on, like, which specific group you're talking
sure.
about.
Do you know how Chief Seattle became chief?
Well, some of them would say he wasn't. The main thing was their word for chief, Siob, it refers to like a whole caste of people. It means the high-blooded mm. people. They don't have any word that specifically means chief. But how Chief Seattle came to his standing within the community, I would phrase it that way, is he was a brilliant military strategist. And he once defeated an entire squad of slave raiders, Native slave raiders, but he knew an exact bend in the river where he could place a log that would smash their canoes when they came down. And then with a much smaller force, he was able to wipe them all out. And that was how he became the military leader of the allied tribes.
Got it.
Which was like a military alliance.
Right. Early NATO.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, David, we really appreciate you being here and sharing Moses Seattle's story with us. So everybody, please, this was just touching on the through line of the book. There's so much detail in this book, and there's so many side stories in this book about other characters, about other people during this time. There's a lot about Princess Angeline and Jim Seattle and... Was it Jim Shelton? I mean, so many different important figures in Native American history in the Puget Sound. And there's a lot of good detail in there. And it's not all a bummer of a book. There are actually quite a few fun stories in here. And it's definitely worth a read. So please check out Burning Moses Seattle and David's other work. And David, do you have any upcoming projects that you'd like to share?
Yeah, the sequel's coming out.
Hey, now.
The Burning of Old Manhouse. That'll be out later this summer.
Excellent.
And a Moses Seattle movie.
Oh,
yes.
A documentary about it.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we're going to have to circle back around and check back in and talk about this as well. And then you were working on the audiobook as well for Burning Moses?
Yes. Yeah. I'm working on the audiobook and then a revised second edition with a bibliography.
Excellent. Well, looking forward to that. And then where can people find your work? What's the best place to go?
Well, right now, Amazon, getting a copy of the book. If you don't like Amazon, it's also available at Left Bank Books in Seattle, Pine Books, Ophelia's Books, and soon the Beacon Cinema.
Excellent.
We'll be carrying it.
Excellent. Excellent. And don't forget, you can also go take a tour with David at Beneath the Streets. That's one of the excellent underground Seattle tours. We went on a tour with David a couple months ago, and it was absolutely fascinating. Learned more about the underground than I ever had, and I've been on at least, you know, half a dozen underground tours.
Same.
The history is better sourced than other tour companies. Let's just put it that way. So I would say that Beneath the Streets is the far superior tour company in downtown Seattle or in Pioneer Square of the ones available. So definitely check them out. At least that's my opinion.
That's right.
But my opinion as well. Usually correct.
I felt it was entertaining without sacrificing truth, as much as we know from history.
David, thank you again. We appreciate your time, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again later in the year.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, David. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Rainy Day Rabbit Holes. We thought maybe you had forgotten. How could you forget? We are your hosts, Shay.
And Jody.
And you can find all things on our website, rainydayrabbitholes.com, like sources, notes, pictures, links, whatnot. That beautiful website is designed and managed by the amazing and talented Letha Davis at easybreezy.com. That's easybreezy, EASYBRZY.com. All episodes are edited and produced by me, Shay, and you can reach out with any questions or comments at shay@rainydayrabbitholes.com. That's SHEA. Thanks for listening. Please share the podcast with your friends and family, and stay curious.
See you down the rabbit hole.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, High Up MAGA Guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.